Tonight, I've decided actually to fudge my title a little bit. Those of you who've signed up to give papers or talks know that you create pictures out of thin air and deliver them to the organizers and then have to live with those things. So I'm actually fudging my title just a little bit to Copernicans and the structure of the universe. To be more precise, I want to introduce you to a gang of four early Copernicans to trace their achievements and to show how some of the issues they tackled and how they tackled them might be relevant to problems we continue to face as scientists, as Christians, and as human beings in the first half of the 21st century. In fact, there are five early Copernicans for whom I profess unashamed admiration and affection. But one of them I've decided to pass over tonight, but I'll mention him just very briefly. His name is Rheticus, and he has some claim to being the very first Copernican, since he outed himself as a Copernican even before Copernicus himself did. Rheticus was Copernicus' self-appointed student who encouraged his teacher to go public with his cosmology, and without whom we might well never have heard of Copernicus. But that's another story, and it was written up by an obscure English professor a little more than a decade ago. Tonight I want to review only four early Copernicans and their truly remarkable achievements. This gang of four I'm referring to all appear in the frontispiece of a work by John Wilkins published in 1640. A discourse concerning a new world and another planet in two books. We're going to spend a little bit of time on this picture tonight. We'll keep coming back to it and zooming in and zooming out and so on. But for now, let me just mention briefly about Wilkins. He was what we might call a third generation Copernican. In 1640, he was looking back over almost 100 years and surveying the Copernican achievement, just as tonight, we're looking back almost 500 years and doing the same thing. I won't say too much more about Wilkins. However, like my gang of four first and second generation Copernicans, he was both a serious scientist and an openly committed Christian. He was, in fact, a clergyman and one of the founders of the Royal Society. He and they could all have happily belonged to the CSCA, if only they were Canadians. So, who are this gang of four I'm claiming appear in Wilkins's picture? Let me list them just chronologically with their dates, one by one, even though I won't stick to strict cosmology. Sorry, I will stick to strict cosmology, not to strict chronology in what I have to say. So, Nicholas Copernicus, Thomas Diggs, Galileo Galilei, Johannes Kepler. First, of course, is Copernicus. He is and was the father of the new cosmology, and in Wilkins's picture, he gestures toward his proposed cosmology and asks, "What if things be thus? Quid si sic?" I hope you're fluent in Latin. You're going to hear lots of it tonight. This is, you know, my humanities guy revenge on the scientists. I understand that astronomers no longer draw happy faces on their sons, but there's Copernicus. There's the sun, radiantly at the center of all things, declaring, I'll give you the English translation, "To all things I give light and heat and motion." Indeed, part of Copernicus's case for his cosmology was the fittingness and convenience of God's having placed the source of light, heat, and motion right in the center. As Copernicus writes in one of the most famous passages of his De Revolutionibus on the revolutions, "Behold, in the midst of all resides the sun. For who in this most beautiful temple would set this lamp in another or better place whence to illuminate all things at once? Truly indeed does the Son, as if seated upon a royal throne, govern his family of planets as they circle about him. It's worth emphasizing here that Copernicus's motivation for locating the Sun in the center was his pre-empirical assumption that a cosmos constructed by an orderly creator would be elegant and harmonious. Copernicus was, as he said, irritated that the philosophers, we would say scientists, relied on a model of the universe that was so inelegant and clumsy as the Ptolemaic model inherited from the past was. But given the heliocentric structure, Copernicus asserts, we discover an orderly arrangement that displays a marvelous symmetry and a firm harmonious connection between the motion and the size of the planets, such as can be discerned by no other means. So great, certainly, is the divine handiwork of him who is himself the greatest and the best. The harmony that Copernicus is talking about is that of the movements of the planets. For with the Sun in the center, the periods of the... I'm going to move to Copernicus's own diagram. With the Sun in the center, the periods of the planets' revolutions exhibit a monotonic progression, increasing with their distance from the Sun, as in this famous diagram from the De Rev. Mercury, 80 days. Venus, 9 months. Earth, 1 year. Mars, 2 years. Jupiter, 12 years. Saturn, 30 years. But of course, the Moon stays with the Earth and goes through a monthly cycle. And of course, our word month is moon, shortened up a little bit. On the scientists really need etymology when they get the opportunity. So, a little bit more of that later. On the topic of the Moon, we notice two other important, mind-blowing things about the Copernican structure of the universe. In the old model, the Moon was one of the seven planets. Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, seven. And of course, we've got 7 days in the week named after them. But now, placed efficiently in the center, the Sun is no longer a planet. Its planetary role has been taken over by the Earth. In one sense, the Earth and the Sun have simply changed places. Look at diagrams of the Ptolemaic and the Copernican system set side by side, and you'll see at this level how simple Copernicus's innovation was. He swaps around the positions of the Sun and the Earth, and suddenly we have planetary machinery that makes sense. But as Wilkins was to point out, once we conceive of Earth as a planet, it's only a small step to conceiving of the planets as other Earths. And you can trace a progression, it's almost a grammatical, lexical progression through the history of science, where Earth becomes Earths, and Moon becomes Moons, as in Moons of Jupiter, and so on. Sun becomes Suns. Milky Way, galaxy becomes galaxies, and now, of course, universe becomes universes. And that imaginative process, which ignited, among other things, science fiction, did so already in the 17th century. It didn't have to wait for Orson Welles or Star Wars. And the process began with our sister planet, the Moon. So back to Wilkins's frontispiece for a moment. Notice the titles in this two-volume, two-part work. The New World and Another Planet. These refer respectively to the Moon, that's the other world, because Wilkins writes about how the Lunarians might behave given their local geography and long days and long nights, and to the Earth. That's the other planet. Because until this moment in history, more or less, nobody thought of Earth as a planet. So now Earth is another planet. It's just tremendously exciting development in the history of thought. And of course, the inhabitants of that planet now have to think of themselves as rotating and revolving through space. It may be easy for us to contemplate, if we're being generous with ourselves, but given that humans for millennia had thought in terms of an unmoving and immovable non-planetary terra firma, Earth's planetary status required a huge imaginative leap. Well, as you possibly know, one of the things assisting that imaginative leap was Galileo's telescope and its discoveries starting in the winter of 1609-1610, particularly the phenomenon of Earthshine. When Galileo observed the faint glow of light upon the dark surface of the moon, he realized that the sun's light was reflecting off the Earth and brightening the otherwise dark moon, just as the same light is reflected off the moon and brightens Earth's dark nights. Wilkins makes this process explicit with the help of lines, as you can see, drawn to show how with the sun's borrowed rays, the Earth and the moon illuminate each other. The caption below the moon's orbit reads, "Mutuo se illuminant," they illuminate each other mutually. Galileo presents this as a kind of sibling generosity. They're members of the same planetary family. These three words, "Mutuo se illuminant," summarize Galileo's poetic account, according to which, quote, "the Earth with fair and grateful exchange pays back to the moon an illumination like that which it receives from the moon nearly the whole time during the darkest gloom of night." Well, having mentioned Galileo, I'd like to jump to members 3 and 4. I'll come back to number 2 later. Of my Copernican gang of 4. Here they are, side by side, or one in front of the other, I suppose you could say if you're being precise. Galileus and Kepler. There, you can see the labels down at the bottom. And their roles in supporting Copernicus are, respectively, observational and mathematical. There's Galileo holding his trademark optic tube, also known as a telescope, declaring, "Hic eius oculi," here be his eyes, that is Copernicus's eyes. While the mathematician Kepler, not wishing to be forgotten, and apparently straining over Galileo's shoulder, adds, "Ut inam et alae," indeed, and his wings. The idea that geometry and arithmetic form a pair of complementary wings goes right back to the ancient world. And of course, you can't ascend into the realms of astronomy unless you use both arithmetic and geometry. I'm going to come back to Kepler in a few minutes, but let me stay for a while with Galileo and his telescope. And let's right away dispose of the erroneous notion that Galileo proved Copernicanism by means of his observations. I've had highly respected astronomers tell me that once Galileo discovered the phases of Venus, it was, as he put it, my friend, the astronomer, game over, and Copernicanism had won. But that is actually just wrong. Venus's phases are similar to the moon's phases. Keep your eye for the moment on the right side in the Copernican model, are similar to the moon's phases in proceeding from full to half to crescent and back again to full. So it's true that after about 1611, Ptolemaism was observationally dead in the water because the Ptolemaic model didn't allow for a full phase of Venus. If you're looking out from Earth toward the sun, Venus is never opposite the sun. However, at the turn of the century, beginning of the 17th century, there was a model proposed by the Danish philosopher and astronomer Tycho Brahe, whom you've probably heard of, that was a involved a non-planetary Earth that was static in the center of the universe. Here's a page from a work published in 1614. This is only 3 years after Galileo's telescopic observations of the phases of Venus. This was published by someone defending Tycho Brahe's geoheliocentric model, demonstrating, as you can see, how the telescopically attested phases of Venus are consistent with this alternative, non-Copernican, geocentric, geostatic model. To put it very briefly, Galileo did not prove Copernicanism, and the cosmological debate remained wide open until approximately the time of Newton, which was much later, in the late 17th century. Now, while we're talking about Galileo and Copernicanism, let me make a further point that I've been trying to drive home now. Some of you have heard me trying to drive it home, and obviously unsuccessfully, for almost two decades. According to what I've dubbed the great Copernican cliché, one of the things Copernicus achieved was a monumental dethroning of the Earth and its inhabitants from its privileged position in the center of the universe. This mistaken notion began to appear about the middle of the 17th century and became an article of faith among Enlightenment thought, as well as among many scientific popularizers on through the 20th century to the present. It almost always appears utterly devoid of any supporting evidence. Its evidence is sort of its being repeated again and again. And I'm not going to bore you with dozens of citations. You can go home and Google Sun Copernicus dethroned, and it'll all start to come up. You'll find one or two things that I've contributed to the debate, but for the most part, it would seem in vain. Just two quick examples. Carl Sagan described Copernicanism as the first of a series of great demotions delivered human pride. I won't go into a long debate with Carl Sagan. I tried to do that once at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and it didn't go over very well because all of those people had been inspired to go into astronomy by watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos back in. So my diplomatic skills failed me that day. But there's another group of scientists. Janet found me this, and anybody can find this sort of thing on the web. They call themselves the Virgo Consortium, and they conduct cosmological supercomputer simulations. I've got nothing bad to say about those supercomputer simulations, but they offer on their website, without any apparent self-doubt, and also without any apparent evidence, what they call the COCO, the Copernicus Complexio. For as long as humans have engaged in scientific thought, one question that has always been raised, I guess they've surveyed the entire literature across the world, do we live in a special place in the universe? The paradigm-shifting claim by Nicholas Copernicus was that the sun and the earth are not really special at all. We are not privileged observers in any sense. So, I mean, I don't mind talking to somebody for whom it's an open debate, but this is so categorical. Anyway, I'll try to calm myself down. Let me put it very briefly and simply. Pre-Copernican cosmology was based on Aristotelian physics, according to which there are four elements: earth, water, air, and fire, which naturally arrange themselves according to their relative heaviness. Did you miss that lesson in Arnold's Physics 101? You can test this physics for yourself if you like. Light a match and watch the flame rise up away from the center. Or pick up a stone, go over to the lake, pick up a stone, drop it, and watch it as it seeks the center of the earth and moves down through both air and any water that lies in its way. You can contemplate this arrangement if we zoom in on the Ptolemaic model we looked at a few minutes ago. There's the Earth with water on top of it, followed by the spheres of air and fire. Air is usually shown with this sort of stylized cloud arrangement. And then, of course, the fire, you can see the flames. Note that the next sphere up is that of the moon, which is why earth, water, air, and fire are known as the sublunary elements. There is, of course, a superlunary fifth element, also known as quintessence or ether, but we don't need to worry about that tonight. The planets move through the ether. Anyhow, obviously, the reason Earth is in the center of the universe, according to Aristotelian physics, is that it's the heaviest thing there is. And heavy things by nature seek the center. And by the way, it's not really just the center of the Earth, it's the center of the universe. That's where heavy, gross things collect. This implies, in turn, that the center is a kind of cosmic pit or sump. It's what the medieval poet Dante identified as the place of hell. The Renaissance, but still pre-Copernican philosopher Giovanni Pico, called our earthly place the excrementary and filthy parts of the lower world. I don't need to get out Roger's thesaurus and give you the Anglo-Saxon versions of excrementary. But in short, there's loads of evidence indicating that pre-Copernican thought saw our and Earth's literally low and lowly location not as a throne, but as a place of exceptional humility. And that means that for the Earth to be raised up out of such a low place was not a demotion, but a promotion. As I've occasionally said to students, if one day you're in a deep, dark pit, and someone comes along and pulls you out of that deep, dark pit, don't immediately assume that you're being dethroned. This account also implies that when Copernicus swapped around the places of the Earth and the Sun in the new model, he was taking a big risk. Not because he was dethroning the Earth, but because he was dethroning the Sun. In fact, the first semi-official response to De Revolutionibus, written by a Dominican friar only a year after its publication, and framed in transparently Aristotelian terms, complained that Copernicus puts the Sun in the center of the universe where everybody else, correctly and most convincingly, proves that the Earth is. He puts the indestructible Sun in a place subject to destruction. In short, Copernicus anticipated the charge that he was relegating the Sun to the cosmic basement. And so he took great pains, rhetorically, to renovate the basement. That's why he goes so over the top in describing the Sun itself as a well-located and magnificent divine ruler. And such was Copernicus' success in reimagining the center that we no longer dream of the Sun as occupying a place of dishonor. Yet Copernicus' cosmological model did entail a repudiation of the Sun's planetary status. And a recent analogy might convey a taste of the emotional impact of that change. Some of you know this story better than others, so I'll give you a few details. In 2006, the International Astronomical Union, meeting in Prague, voted to downgrade Pluto, which had been discovered in 1930, to the status of dwarf planet. Poor little Pluto. A huge PR brouhaha broke out in the media, even in state legislatures, and among admirers of Pluto's discoverer. And then the American Dialect Society subsequently named Plutoed as its word of the year for 2006. To Pluto is to demote or devalue someone or something as happened to the former planet Pluto. All this reaction concerned mere technical vocabulary as it pertained to a celestial object never observed by the naked human eye, and one discovered by Clyde Tombaugh only 76 years before its 2006 demotion. So my question really is there's an analogy, but a disanalogy. How much more of a shock must it have entailed for Copernicus to Pluto the sun? Of all the visible objects in the universe, the one that for millennia and across countless cultures had been an object of highest honor, if not outright worship. So again, if the sun in the Copernican model was being Pluto, then the Earth was being recognized as a planet in the classical sense, one of the stellae errantes, one of the wandering stars. Earth was being exalted to stellar status. This is something that Galileo saw very clearly. He makes a point of it in his 1610 description of Earthshine, which he says serves as a lesson to those who assert, principally on the grounds that it has neither motion nor light, that the earth must be excluded from the dance of the stars. For I will prove that the earth does have motion, that it surpasses the moon in brightness, and that it is not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. And so I ask, does this sound like a demotion to you? And yet, after now many years of trying to explode the great Copernican cliché, I'm prepared to admit there are aspects of Copernicanism that continue to challenge our thinking about ourselves and our planet within the cosmic structure. I'm mainly talking about questions raised by the sheer magnitude of the universe. Did you notice in our earlier comparison of the Ptolemaic and Copernican models, there are different depictions of the sphere of the fixed stars? No, you didn't, because they are virtually identical. And it's worth remembering that Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler all thought of the sphera stellarum fixarum, sphere of the fixed stars, as being bounded, as being a sphere. So despite these diagrammatic similarities, however, and we should never treat these diagrams as being to scale in any sense, but despite the diagrammatic similarities of the stellar spheres on the left and the right, Copernicans were forced to conclude that the stars must be much farther away than Ptolemy thought. Physicists and astronomers in the room can express this better than I can, but let me try. Ptolemy realized that we can't detect diurnal stellar parallax. If you look at the stars just after sunset and just before sunrise, you won't be able to detect any parallax, any apparent geometrical rearrangement of the stars. And that implies, if you're doing this at the equator, that the diameter of the Earth is as nothing compared to the stellar distance. However, in Copernicus's model, we can't detect any annual stellar parallax. If you sight on the stars, for example, at the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, 6 months apart, you'll still not be able to detect any geometrical rearrangement of the stars. And that implies that the entire diameter, not of the Earth, but of the Earth's annual orbit, is as nothing compared to the stellar distance. This is very hard, certainly was very hard to believe. And this, in turn, requires an orders of magnitude increase in estimates of the size of the stellar sphere that your model must accommodate. And yet, Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler all continue to insist that that enlarged stellar sphere, though immense, remember, immense means immeasurable, is bounded. Now, Here's where the much-neglected second member of our Copernican Gang of Four enters upon the stage. You all will have heard of Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler, but you might never have come across the name Thomas Diggs. Number two on our list. Diggs observed and discussed the supernova of 1572, even though the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe, whom I've already mentioned, dominates accounts of that phenomenon, which, by the way, proved decisively that change takes place in the universe above the sphere of the moon. And Diggs is now most famous, I think, for a single diagram, which you may indeed have seen. It accompanied what Diggs in 1576 called a perfect description of the celestial orbs. This little work included the first ever published cosmological sections of Copernicus's treatise translated into a vernacular. Yes, into the English language, which at that time was a merely insular and peripheral European dialect. So, if you're a native speaker of English, be a little bit proud of this on Copernican grounds. And remarkably, Diggs appeared on the scene as a scientifically credentialed proponent of Copernicus a full 20 years before Kepler did the same thing. So 1576, Kepler's first open declarations, 1596. So he was a really early Copernican. Moreover, he asserted Copernicanism not just as a useful hypothesis, but as scientific truth. Not for him the notion that, well, Copernicanism is just a hypothesis. No. He said heliocentrism is philosophical, truly averred, which is sort of a pleonasm that means truly, truly true. He's a wonderful Copernican and a wonderful writer. But most dramatically, Diggs totally abandoned the idea of a bounded stellar sphere. He doesn't explicitly acknowledge that he's actually going beyond the teaching of Copernicus, but there it is in black and white. In case you can't read the all caps writing underneath the stellar sphere, I've printed it out there for you. This orb of stars, fixed infinitely up, extendeth itself in altitude spherically and therefore immovable, the palace of felicity garnished with perpetual shining glorious lights innumerable, far excelling our sun, both in quantity and quality. And there are many things that could be said about Diggs's innovation, but one of them is that if you thought Copernicus Plutoed the sun by placing it in the center and denying it planetary status, then how much more is Diggs demoting the sun by claiming that it is dwarfed by innumerable other stars far exceeding it both in quantity and quality? It was, and still is in a way, a shocking claim, yet it harmonizes quite easily with the more modern astronomer's claim that our sun is at best a very ordinary garden variety G-class yellow star situated in no particularly distinguished location somewhere in the nondescript fringes of the galaxy. So in some ways, Diggs's version of heliocentrism was more, I hesitate to use this term, more advanced than the versions of Galileo and Kepler, even though Diggs died, before either of those great astronomers went public with their Copernicanism. Yet it's obvious that Diggs's influence was great, and it was ongoing. All right, let me come clean here. You may already have caught me out on this. You may already have suspected earlier on when I claimed that each member of the Copernican Gang of Four appears in Wilkins's 1640 frontispiece. Diggs is not, in fact, himself portrayed in that picture. In the frontispiece, we may see Copernicus's and Galileo's and Kepler's faces, but just as dramatically, we see Diggs's cosmology with its unbounded realm of diffuse and innumerable stars. As I implied earlier, the new cosmos that the Copernicans in their varying degrees saw coming into view was one that was not only larger, but also more dynamic than the one inherited from Ptolemy. As indicated by Galileo's wonderful phrase, "dance of the stars," he in particular championed a vision that obliterated the hard distinction between the sublunary and the superlunary domains, thus dismantling the so-called two-story universe. Depending on your point of view, therefore, Galileo either raised Earth to the level of the heavens, or, more disturbingly, perhaps, reduced the heavens to the level of the Earth. For example, with his telescope, Galileo discovered that the surface of the moon was not smooth and perfect, as had been assumed, but instead had mountains and was therefore truly Earth-like. Galileo, clever fellow that he was, even measured how high those mountains must be. And he did so by observing shadows cast by the mountains and by employing geometry. Remember, geometry means earth measure. A couple of years later, he also famously observed sunspots, a discovery that was controversial because the sun was an even more venerated celestial body than the moon. And here was Galileo claiming that it was not as immaculata, immaculate, literally unspotted or without blemish, as everyone believed it was. As one sardonic poet at the time put it, Galileo was using his Flemish glass to reveal filth on the cheeks of the sun. That's why talk about sunspots was regarded as almost blasphemous. In short, a whole series of discoveries, including, as already mentioned, the existence and location of supernovas, indicated a qualitative affinity between Earth and the heavens, and therefore undermine the very assumptions of that two-story universe. By the way, some of you here are interested in theology, and I think it's not hard to see how this changing conception of the structure of the universe might also have theological implications. For example, what about that key petition in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done in earth as in heaven"? Both the koine and the Vulgate of this phrase place heaven first, so that a literal translation might be, "as in heaven, so also on earth." The prayer is that earth should become more like heaven. However, unless one is very careful to keep the senses of heaven distinct, with the heaven of the Lord's Prayer perhaps meaning the transcendent realm of God, rather than merely the sky, the heavens above, the cosmological revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries could be seen to militate against the order of values implied by that petition. I mean, I think it doesn't, but you can see how it might. In short, it could suggest not Earth becoming more like heaven, but instead heaven or the heavens being much more like Earth than anyone had guessed. Some commentators have suggested that the cosmological revolution's deeply grasped affinities between Earth and the heavens can be read as, quote, a desacralization of the heavens. I would put the matter quite the other way around. Galileo's and others' extension of earthly qualities of generation and vitality outward into a newly conceived universe implies instead, and I want to put this moderately, a sacralization of Earth. For in Copernicanism, as I've pointed out, Earth is indeed a star, albeit a wandering star, a planet, possessing stellar nobility. The new understanding that arose from evidence of celestial alterations, mutations, and generations did not require that the heavens now be considered ignoble. However, it did imply that Earth's mutability could no longer be taken as evidence of its ignobility. So the new cosmology's axiological implications can be put very simply. The heavens are noble, but not immutable. Earth is mutable, but not therefore ignoble. Let's press this logic a bit further. Mutability is not only universal, but also in significant respects superior to immutability. This radical claim, the case for the positive value of mutability, is enunciated beautifully in Galileo's Dialogue on the World Systems. What, it is asked, is so desirable about things that are impassable, immutable, unalterable? Notice things. I mean, we can predicate those adjectives of God in some sense, but why the rest of the universe? Indeed, the character Sagredo in the Dialogue gives this emphatic comment. And Arnold said no more than 6 or 7 lines of text in a slide, but I'm a textual guy. So anyway, I want you to hear what Sagredo has to say in the Dialogue. I consider the earth very noble. This word keeps coming up again and again. Very noble and admirable precisely because of the diverse alterations, changes, generations, etc., that occur in it incessantly. If not being subject to any changes, it were a vast desert of sand or a mountain of jasper, or if at the time of the flood the waters which covered it had frozen and it had remained an enormous globe of ice where nothing was ever born or ever altered or changed, I should deem it a useless lump in the universe. This is exactly the difference between a living animal and a dead one. I earlier mentioned how Galileo in the Sidereus Nuncius, his account of his first telescopic observations, employed geometry, earth measure, as a universal yardstick whose application lent support to a version of a single homogeneous cosmos. In the Dialogo, however, earth functions as a measure, a criterion, in further profound respects. And now it is the immutable heavens of the Aristotelian-Ptolemaic cosmos that are measured and found wanting. To repeat Sagredo's formulation, the difference between earth and those imagined immutable heavens would be the same as between a living and a dead creature. In the Dialogo, Simplicio, the Dialogue has different characters in it, Simplicio, the Aristotelian, replies that the heavenly bodies do not need to change. The sun, the moon, and the other stars, which are ordained to have no use other than the service of the earth, these need nothing more than motion and light to achieve their end. But Sagredo, who is actually kind of the middleman in the Dialogue, uncharacteristically passionate, scoffs at this reasoning. Has nature then produced and directed all these enormous, perfect, and most noble celestial bodies, invariant, eternal, and divine, for no other purpose than to serve the changeable, transitory, and mortal earth? Asked Sagredo. To serve that which you call the dregs of the universe? The sink of all uncleanness? Take away this purpose of serving the earth, and the innumerable host of the celestial bodies is left useless and superfluous, since they have not and cannot have any reciprocal activities among themselves, all of them being, I think he was sarcastic, inalterable, immutable, and invariant. Besides, it seems to me that at such times as the celestial bodies are contributing to the generations and alterations on the earth, they too must be alterable. Otherwise, I do not see how the influence of the moon or sun in causing generations on the earth would differ from placing a marble statue beside a woman and expecting children from such a union. This is one of the finest pieces of Renaissance rhetoric I've come across. The brilliantly audacious analogy of the woman and the marble statue graphically implies a new cosmology in which things of earth are projected outward into the universe. Change, generation, life, fertility, sex, and maybe ET. But the most stunning feature of the newly conceived universe that was not Earth-like was its sheer size. Even if one still imagined that universe to be in some sense bounded or finite. As mentioned earlier, the absence of diurnal stellar parallax already told Ptolemy in the 2nd century that the sphere of the fixed stars was immense, literally immeasurable. Yet for the Copernicans, the absence of annual stellar parallax gave immense, the word immense, a whole new jaw-dropping set of implications. Now it wasn't just the Earth that was, as a point, infinitesimal in relation to the size of the starry sphere. It was the entire annual orbit of the Earth that became infinitesimal in comparison with the sphera stellarum fixarum. All this being the case, Copernicans might yet leave us, Earth inhabitants, feeling indeed rather small, a bit Plutoed. So, did Copernicus demote us after all? Kepler tackled this issue head on in his work on the new star of 1604, De Stella Nova. I've already mentioned the 1572 supernova, but with great luck, another supernova appeared only 32 years later. Scientists, in their poetic way, referred to it as SN1604. And it was, in fact, the last supernova to have occurred that was observable to the naked eye. The 16th chapter of Kepler's work was translated into English and published just 3 months ago by my friend and sometime co-author Christopher Graney. And the title of that chapter is Concerning the Immensity of the Sphere of the Fixed Stars in the Hypothesis of Copernicus. Kepler mentions that his former teacher, Tycho Brahe, finds the implied structure and proportions of the Copernican universe insane, I'm quoting, insane and contemptible. How huge the fault in the human body, Tycho says, if the nose might surpass by many times the bulk of the whole remainder of the body. Well, Kepler, for his part, simply refuses to be cowed by this kind of objection. As is his mathematical habit, he crunches numbers to demonstrate how small we are, even relative to the Earth. He calculates, and he sort of lowballs this, actually, if you want to do the arithmetic. He calculates, for example, that you'd need to lay out 6 million people head to foot before they could stretch around the Earth's circumference. I think it's closer to 40, but we'll let Kepler go. He's a better mathematician than I am. Kepler, in effect, shrugs and replies, "So what? Why all the fuss about size?" As he puts it, truly the universe is not large to God, but we are small to the universe. In short, the value of something, the importance of something, is not determined by its mere magnitude. As we zoom in from the sphere of the fixed stars and enter the realm of the planets, Kepler writes, we come to this, our tiny ball, our little cottage, which we call Earth, the womb of growing things, herself fashioned by a certain internal faculty and in turn the architect of marvelous work. She kindles daily from herself so many little living things, plants, fishes, insects, that she may easily scorn the remaining bulk of things in view of this her own nobility. Let's listen to Kepler a little longer. Lastly, behold, if you will, the little bodies we call animals. What smaller than these can be imagined in comparison to the universe? But there now, behold, feeling, voluntary motions, an infinite architecture of bodies. And behold, among these fine bits of dust called humans, to whom the Creator granted that in a certain way they may beget themselves, clothe themselves, defend themselves, teach themselves an infinity of arts, and daily grow in goodness. In these is the image of God, and these, in a certain sense, are masters of the whole bulk. So what is it to us? This is still Kepler. So what is it to us that the body of the universe possesses a great breadth, while the soul possesses none? Thus we may discern the good pleasure of the Creator, who is author alike of the roughness of the large masses and of the perfection of tiny things. Yet he glories not in sheer bulk, but ennobles those he wished to be small. In the end, through these intervals, from Earth to the Sun, from Sun to Saturn, from Saturn to the fixed stars, we may learn to rise step by step toward a recognition of the immensity of divine power. So what I'm suggesting this evening is that the early Copernicans furnish us with some powerful tools of thought with which we might resist the loose talk that we still hear about how Copernicus and maybe astronomy and science more generally leave us and our precious home planet diminished, Plutoed, insignificant. Many will remember Carl Sagan inviting us on an imaginative journey to the outer edges of the solar system, from whence we look back at what he called our pale blue dot. "Now try to convince yourself," Sagan wrote, "that God created the whole universe for one of the 10 million or so species of life that inhabit that speck of dust." In fact, Copernicus never wrote that God created the world merely for us. He does say, propter nos, for our sakes, but he never says, merely for us. So why this urge to badmouth something that's so precious just because it's small? Surely Kepler's humble but joyous approach to us who are dust and to our Earth, so cosmically minute, offers greater hope, greater motivation for protecting and preserving something that we increasingly realize is very precious and very fragile. The early Copernicans thus offer us an ethos that encourages us to treasure each other and our fellow creatures, and to prize this our stellar blue-green planet while marveling and hoping in the immensity, the magnificence of the divinity who framed our universe. Thank you very much.
In the illustration, it seems like everything has meanings that were unknown to me, and I'm just curious, what's the meaning of the eagle-like creature there Galileo?
This one? I don't know for sure, honestly, but I suspect that it has something to do with the two wings. Utinam et ali, ali, as in, you know, aileron is wings. And there have to be two of them for the bird to be able to fly, and I think it's just a symbol of a rising up on the wings of geometry and arithmetic. But that's really just an educated guess. Thanks.
You, Holly?
Hi, Holly.
Hi, Dr. Danielson. I just wanted to ask if you could clarify Clarify for me. So you're arguing that actually this repositioning of the universe was the elevation of the earth and not a dethronement. Could you just clarify, in the 17th century, if there was some debate over how this was seen? Is this your theory that you're arguing, or that it's rooted in the Renaissance view of this shift? Mm-hmm. Or is this actually how this restructuring of the universe was perceived in Galileo Copernicus's time?
Thanks. Yeah, I always, as you could probably guess, I always like the earlier sources rather than the later sources. And you can see, from take two Italians, Pico. We live in the filthy and excrementary parts of the lower world, and Galileo, who, once he saw that the earth was reflecting light onto the moon, just as the moon reflects light onto the earth, realized that this was a piece of evidence against the earlier view, against the view that we're here in the pits. And the language that he uses, that earth gains its position in the dance of the stars, and it's no longer the sump where the universe is filth and ephemera collect. The word that he uses in both Latin and Italian is sentina, which was the description of the place in a ship that was below the lowest floorboards where the bilge waters would collect. So sump is my favorite translation. And it's only into the 1640s, but especially into the 1680s with Le Bouvier de Fontenelle, that Copernicus starts to appear as someone who is liberating us from a view of Earth as special, as privileged, and then that builds. So until about the middle of the 17th century, I don't see anybody who interprets Copernicus in the modernistic way. But then it kind of gets going. I've got a number of them in the article I did 18 years ago for American Journal of Physics. Goethe has a major Enlightenment figure, of course. He talks about the immense insult to Earth being removed from that special place. But I think the other side of it is that, as I said, Copernicus renovated the basement. He had to make the center appear as a place of honor because he was putting the sun there. And once we've bought into the center as the throne room, then of course Earth was taken out of it. But there's an anachronism that underlies that reading.
So, yeah, Dennis, hi. Very nice presentation.
Hey.
There's something about the Copernican principle that you seem not to have covered. I'm wondering if you've encountered it. So the general dictum in science is, guess what? We don't live in a special place in the universe. We're not important, yada, yada.
Right.
But it fails miserably when it comes to time. If you apply the Copernican principle to time, it suggests the universe basically is the same now as it was infinitely long ago and infinitely long in the future. It's called the perfect cosmological principle.
Right.
And we know this not to be correct. Have you ever talked to people or encountered them with this kind of dialogue about this kind of limit to applying the principle?
Yeah, I have. I'm going to do the really boring thing that academics do and refer to their own published work, okay? So I had a little article a number of years ago in American Scientist called The Bones of Copernicus, in which this all started when I was talking to Jim Peebles at a reception and said, I'm really interested in the Copernican principle. Would you be willing to be interviewed about this? So I interviewed about 20 scientists, George Ellison, others whose names I'm going to forget and show my scientific illiteracy. But one of the people I talked to was Larry Krauss. Strange bedfellows, really. And he's done some work on how, with the expansion of the universe, our foundation of knowledge in observations of other galaxies is going to diminish over time. And so that we're actually at a privileged place in cosmological time to be beneficiaries of those observations. So I'll give you a copy of that. But I'm no expert on it. I was interviewing experts and who do talk about the perfect cosmological principle. Excellent point.
So it's my understanding that the place of hell is appropriately at the center of the Earth in the Aristotelian picture. What happens to Hades and Sheol here when we elevate the Earth? Is it still in a bad place?
I would certainly assume so. Sorry, I don't want to be facetious about hell, but it's no longer in the Earth. And so I'm going to go back to the introduction and bootstrap with Milton. Milton places hell on the far side of chaos. Chaos is a kind of primordial, boundless realm that, of course, becomes inhabited by Satan. And to get to Earth, Satan doesn't come up from the center of our precious planet. He comes to Earth sailing across the boundless waste of chaos from hell. So there's a nice pair of bookends for you, Dante and Milton, with hell in the center. And some, who is it who said that the medieval cosmos is actually not an anthropocentric universe, it's a diabolocentric. Did I touch on you? Yeah, thank you very much.
C.S. Lewis's book, The Discarded Image,
yes,
deals with that, the whole kind of Aristotelian cosmology
exactly
in
right
that way that you're describing.
Yes.
And I think disabuses people of the notion that being at the center
yes
was being
a very good book that and yeah. Lewis does a wonderful job in The Discarded Image. He talks about the medieval picture as being anthropo-peripheral rather than anthropocentric.
I was just thinking with regards to the who God is in all this. I mean, if God is considered immutable as well, I mean, and then all of a sudden the stars are no longer immutable. Did that have any sort of impact on people's view of God?
I think it. I can't trace it with great exactitude, but I think it must have. If the superlunary realm is immutable, then it's consistent with some kind of immutable theology. So God is up there, and immutable things are up there. We still use the language of up there in heaven, God's throne being up there. But if you're thinking literalistically, then, you know, Canadians and Australians are going to have different conceptions of where heaven is. So I think a lot of these things have forced a deliteralization of our theological categories. Let's just go back to Diggs for a moment. He sees that infinite bounded realm as being the place of the palace of felicity. So he's still fusing notions of heaven with that superior realm in some sense. I don't know that it's sustainable, frankly. I'm not really a theologian, but if we think about, I mean, if we believe in heaven and we think about heaven as the place of the throne of God, I'm not sure that we can do it within any kind of Newtonian space-time continuum or even a more Einsteinian version of that. That's a great question. I just don't have anything definitive on that.
This is a bit of a follow-up question to that from an Old Testament scholar who struggled with this question of what does heaven mean in the Bible? It's pretty clear that in the Bible, heaven never means an immaterial dimension. It means what's up out there beyond Earth.
Yeah.
So the question is that when the modern scientific project of actually examining the heavens comes into being. Is that when heaven gets invented as another dimension to make sense of it? Have you encountered that in the literature anywhere?
I honestly can't say that I've had, and I would hesitate to answer a question from somebody I know knows a lot more about this than I do. What are your thoughts?
I don't know about the history. The way I would put it in the Bible is there aren't two heavens. There is just what's out there.
Uh-huh.
But since we can't have access to the sky, it becomes a symbol for God's transcendence.
Yeah.
So you find in very prophetic texts, God will judge the angels who are corrupt in the stars.
Mm-hmm.
They're identified almost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They don't make that because it's transcendence. We now, when we study the heavens, have to make a distinction, but they never made that distinction.
Okay, well,
but I'd like to see what happens in the history of thought. That's interesting.
Yes, yes. Thanks very much. And while we're talking about distance, just get thinking about Robert Mann's point a moment ago. You know, the immensity of distance is paralleled by the immensity of time, and one of the things that lots of people, but certainly Christians, continue to struggle with is how to make sense of, as it were, local history of spending a couple of thousands of years with the kinds of numbers that, among others, geologists and astronomers posit. Does that make us Plutoed in some sense, chronologically, temporally, the way it might spatially? But that's a whole other chapter I decided not to flip open for this talk.
Yeah, you actually anticipated my question. You say you don't want to flip it open. I'll make it small.
Sure.
is there anything in your readings of the Copernicans where they start speculating about the age of the universe?
Actually, no. I do think that vastly expanded. Well, there are 17th century discussions about the pre-Adamites. So they stretch the bounds of human history, but not so much earthly or cosmological history. I suspect that that's a more recent development. I think that the strong analogy between distance and time that we've learned from our physics teacher's knees wasn't as fully internalized in the 16th and 17th century. But that's all, as far as I know.
There are some interesting speculations in early Jewish and Christian interpretation of biblical texts with respect to actually the possibility of not concurrent but successive universes. So in Midrash Rabbah, Genesis Rabbah, for example, there's talk about God creating the world and then discarding it because it wasn't pleasing. And this happening numerous times.
Right.
And I think Origen also, in the second and third century, talks about the possibility of multiple successive worlds or universes. So there is speculation to that extent. It's different than the idea of alternate universes,
mm-hmm.
that, mm-hmm. you know, the multiverse, that type of thing.
Oh, that's very instructive. Thank you. Always a good idea to give Dennis the last word.
There's altogether too many Dennises in this conversation, and I apologize. At least this Dennis is not a scientist. Dennis, it's fairly common for biologists like myself to either imply or directly state that there are lessons to be learned from this episode of Christianity and science, and the ones that are more current, such as evolution or population genetics. I'm just curious what your thoughts might be on that thing, on that sort of approach. Am I offside to imply that? What sort of lessons can we learn? Just interested in your thoughts.
Are you gesturing toward a parallel between cosmological discovery and biological discovery?
Yeah, something along those lines. The church, something maybe to put it sort of roughly, something along the lines of, oh, the church needs to, we were offside 400 years ago, so we shouldn't be offside this time around. That sort of
right.
Thing.
Well, I mean, I think in a lecture of yours, you've got that lovely quotation from Augustine who suggests that if we shoot it off our mouths ignorantly in the presence of people who really know what's what, we're not going to strengthen our case. You probably have that more fluently memorized than I do. These are difficult issues. In the little précis that I submitted a long time ago, you know, I indicated that we just don't have the answer to all of these questions. I think we have to be open to evidence. We have to be open to reinterpretations. I think it's helpful to know that there are very few readers of the Bible in whatever circle who are insisting that Copernicanism, there are some, but insisting that Copernicanism must be wrong because Joshua commanded the sun to stand still. That sort of fast and loose proof texting. Maybe there are lessons there. When it comes to time frames and the sorts of things that you speak so eloquently about, I personally find them difficult to interpret, and I just have to put in abeyance some of my doubts and maybe some of my dogmatism. My bedrock, I think I would put it this way, and it sounds like a cliche, but it's a true cliche. All truth is God's truth. And if it's true, then believers in the creator of the universe have nothing to fear from it. Thanks.
Let us thank Dennis once again.